Welcome to Hot Grease. I'm your host, Nicole Taylor. This Heritage Radio Network program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Whole Foods Market reminds you that every bite has a story. So whether it's a tomato, a muffin, or a T-bone steak, your conscious food choices can change the planet. Because at Whole Foods Market, every single purchase you make help us support things like animal welfare, organic agriculture, equitable trade, and energy offsets. Let's think before we eat. Let's retake our plates. Delicious tweets, see instant sale alerts, enter contests, find answers, and get cooking. Follow Whole Foods Market on Twitter at Whole Foods NYC. Every week on Hot Grease, we bring sustainability, local foods, and forward-thinking schools of culinary thought to the minds and kitchens of everyday folks. Our conversations cover the entire spectrum of food enthusiasts, from renowned culinary masters to moms on a budget. Today, we'll be talking tomatoes and the power of Farmer Jane. Marion Nessel says this about Ripe, the search for the perfect tomato. Arthur Allen, Tomato Odyssey takes him to every link in its production chain, from genetics to Chinese packing companies. Anyone who cares about how tomatoes taste will be fascinated by this journey, will never view pizza sauce the same way again, and will treasure those backyard summer wonders even more. On Hot Grease today, we have the author of the great book, Ripe, The Search for the Perfect Tomato, Arthur Allen. Welcome to Hot Grease.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. Sorry about that.
No problem. Arthur, I'm going to show my age and confess I do not remember Rotten Tomatoes used to express political anger. And you talk about that in the introductory chapter of your book. Do tell. Yes. Give our listeners just a brief history of tomatoes.
Well, I mean, the tomato used to be, the commercial tomato, that is a tomato that you get at the store, used to be a lot softer, a lot thinner skinned, a lot more irregular shaped. And actually, a lot of them went bad before you bought them. And so there were always plenty of rotten tomatoes around. And any time a politician showed up, they were likely to get tomatoed. And I was struck by something going through a lot of old clips of the New York Times and other newspapers, just that this practice kind of started coming to a close as the modern tomato, in the sense of modern breeding techniques, became more common. And the more, the thicker the tomatoes got, the less they were used to attack politicians with.
I haven't heard of any recent attacks with tomatoes with politicians. Or did I miss that?
I saw that Sarah Palin was attacked with that, but I think people try to throw pretty much anything they can get at her, so there are exceptions to the rule.
So what are your thoughts on food magazines covering, speaking of Sarah Palin and politics, what are your thoughts on food magazines covering food politics, particularly the now defunct Gourmet magazine actually did a story about tomato farmers?
Yeah, I thought I was really surprised to see that. It didn't kind of click with my image of Gourmet, but I guess Gourmet had changed a lot. They were covering this group of farmers down in Florida, farm workers, really, who do this really difficult work, really, really hard work, and get paid very little for it. And I went out with these farmers a couple of days and picked tomatoes just to see what it was like, and developed a huge amount of sympathy for their plight. And it's this odd thing where down in Florida, during the winter months, it's the main place in the U.S. where tomatoes are grown, except for greenhouses. But the Florida tomato industry, basically, they're just growing these tomatoes that don't have much flavor that go, that mostly are sold to the fast food industry. And the fast food industry really squeezes the tomato growers, and they pass that along to the workers who get paid, you know, very low wages. And it's a really kind of a miserable situation down there.
You have a chapter that basically gives a foundation on understanding the tomato of 2010. And I think that one chapter is titled Tomato Genetics. For some people that are listening, I know when I started reading the book, I'm like, tomato genetics? What does that mean? Can you just briefly describe tomato genetics?
Yeah, so tomatoes have, you know, undergone, I mean, the tomatoes have been surprisingly well studied by science, and they're pretty easy to sort of manipulate. And I don't mean that in the sense of doing genetic manipulation in the laboratory, but it's pretty easy to study the genes of tomatoes and to figure out, just through traditional breeding, and to figure out ways to bring new genes into tomatoes. So, you know, for years and years, and if you're a backyard farmer, especially on the East Coast, you'll know this is still true, people's tomatoes are attacked by all kinds of blights, fungi, and creatures of other sorts. And so the farmers were looking for a way to get around this, and one of the ways that they did was to introduce new genes from sort of tomato relatives that grow in South America and Peru and Chile and places like that. And through crossbreeding, some of these resistance genes, you know, that make the tomato resistant to these blights and so on, have been brought into commercial tomatoes. So most of the, if you go to a regular garden store and you look and you see on the hybrid tomato seeds package, it'll say VF.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Verticillium and the Fusarium. Those are two common wilts that attack tomatoes. And what that means is that tomato is resistant to those. And that's, you know, like a relatively recent invention. I mean, it's less than it's about 60, 70 years old. And some of those genes came about as a result of these, you know, gene prospectors going down to South America and finding these genes of interest in these related plants and in wild tomatoes, and then sort of introducing them into the plant. But they've also done things like introduce, you know, thick skins, and other characteristics that are good for a farmer but not necessarily good for an eater.
Right.
And there's always this tension in agriculture between, you know, the farmers generally want high yields because they get paid relatively little, and because they don't get that much of what ultimately gets the consumer pays, and of course the consumer is more interested in flavor. So the bottom line is, if you want flavor, you got to pay for it. And we kind of over the years have, for the most part, gotten out of that habit with tomatoes, and that's why you get these kind of tasteless, bland tomatoes. But that's really changed a lot in the last 10, 20 years, where there's a lot of really good, I think there's actually a lot of pretty good tasting tomatoes you can find if you go to the right stores and get the right ones.
Totally. Speaking of prices and high yields, tomatoes are big business. And the first thing that comes to my mm-hmm. mind when I think about big business and big ag and tomatoes, I think about fast food ketchup packets. I don't know why, but that's what I think of. And you have a chapter in your book titled Mess Business. And you actually talk about Heinz, and I'm trying to remember, didn't you visit a Heinz factory or a tomato field that basically supplied tomatoes?
I wanted to visit a Heinz factory, but they wouldn't let me. But I did visit a field. There's a company in California called Morning Star Company.
Right.
It's not to be confused with, there's another one called Morning Star that's one word, and they're like a natural foods company. This company, they have a couple hundred employees, and they produce about a third of all the tomatoes that are grown in the U.S. are processed by them, and that includes like all the commercial tomatoes. So they have these vast acreages, which are which they grow basically, I mean, it's technically grown by farmers, but they do the planting, they do the harvesting, they do the processing. And the tomatoes that they use are these funny little oval-shaped tomatoes that have very little flavor, but they produce prodigiously. I mean, the yields are immense, and they're picked mechanically by these gigantic machines, which are amazing to watch. They pick like about a ton in about 20 seconds of tomatoes. And then they go into these processing plants, and they get turned into paste, which is concentrated paste. And that paste, I mean, when you buy a little tiny can of tomato paste in the store, that's actually already been diluted. So this concentrated paste is extremely diluted. They take a lot of the water out of it. But that then gets sent to Heinz, and Heinz turns it into ketchup. You know, other companies turn it into tomato pizza sauce or spaghetti sauce. And the ketchup, I mean, so I was out in this field where, you know, Heinz is the biggest, is probably the most important, you know, customer of this Morningstar company. So they have a time of the year in August that they call the Heinz Pack. And everything that they harvest that goes into their gigantic, you know, processing plant is tomatoes that are going to be turned into ketchup. So you can go out in these tomato fields and they're just, you know, they're just huge numbers of tomatoes all ripening at once. And they're all getting harvested. They fill up these two trailers in about 20 minutes full of tomatoes, 50 tons. And that's all going to be turned into ketchup. It's just kind of amazing to watch.
Totally amazing. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and we are going to come back with author Alan. And we're talking tomatoes on Hot Grease. You dance up on tomatoes. Keep your info on the scene while they jumping around you. They trying to take all of your dreams, but you can't allow it. Because, baby, whether you're high, welcome back to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. Check our program schedule and show archives on heritageradionetwork.com. We're chatting with author Alan, a former Associated Press foreign correspondent. He's written for the New York Times Magazine, The New Republic, The Washington Post, and Salon Magazine. We were just talking big business and tomatoes. And you bring a very interesting point when we're talking about Big Ag and what people think when they hear the word tomato. Besides ketchup packets for me, I also think Italy. I think about great Italian sauces. But you highlight what a lot of people may not know, and that's tomatoes being produced in China.
Yeah, I was really amazed to learn that in the last couple of years, China has actually taken over the number two place in production of canned tomatoes after California. Almost all the tomatoes that they produce get turned into this concentrated paste I was talking about. And they grow them out in western China, and it's a really interesting political, cultural kind of story, because this area of western China, I don't know, maybe some of your listeners would have heard about these riots that occurred, I guess, last year involving the Uyghur Muslim minority population in this area. And it's an area that basically the Chinese state, you know, wants to sinicize, and they've sent, so they've sent generations of soldiers there, and this very large military company works there, and they and a lot of the farmers are actually former soldiers, and they're, you know, growing anything they can to make money, because they got to do something. They can't you know, afford to pay for all these people just sitting around with guns in their hands. And so they're growing cotton, they're growing melons, they're growing all kinds of things. But one of the big things is these paste tomatoes. And I went out there with a group called the World Processing Tomato Council, which certainly never knew existed before. And they were a lovely group of fun fellows. from all over the world, and women. And we went around on these buses and visited these fields and refineries. And, you know, there's a lot of concern in Italy because this paste, you know, Italy has traditionally sold a lot of canned tomato products all over the world, and China is starting to cut in on some of that market. You don't see their products in the U.S. basically at all, because they don't make the kind of whole tomatoes that Italy exports, that are sort of the high-end, you know, product that you see in stores here, like the San Marzano tomatoes,
right,
or things like that. They're making just industrial paste that's going into sauces and things. But the Italians were sort of shocked a few years ago to learn that that Chinese paste was actually being sold in Italy, because Italy some years has sort of shortages for a variety of reasons having to do with their agricultural policy. And they actually currently are importing a lot of California tomato paste, believe it or not.
Wow.
But one year, so they now have this rule where you have to say where the paste was grown, and it's basically a way of keeping Chinese paste out of Italy.
Well, your book is fascinating for the food geek, and you do an excellent job of painting the picture of the tomato's birth. It's just not all full of just, you know, factoids, but you actually tell great stories. What are the main takeaways?
Thank you.
You're welcome. What are the main takeaways from Ripe, and why would one of my listeners go pick up your excellent book?
Well, I one thing that I was sort of interested to learn, I sort of came to it thinking, but just not knowing, like, I didn't really know the difference between an heirloom and a hybrid, and I didn't have much of a sense of how these foods get to us. I mean, I wanted to do a book about food first, and then I sort of focused on tomatoes. And I guess partly, I learned to really respect almost all of these farmers. I mean, there's some tough people there, but from the small heirloom farmers to some of these medium-sized farmers, yeah, it's a tough job farming. It's
right.
Really hard, and it's very hard to grow good food, and so I really respect people who do it.
Well, author, thank you for joining us on Hot Grease. We look
well,
forward
thank
to
you so much for having me.
No, thank you, and we look forward to chatting with you soon. Author's book is titled Ripe, The Search for the Perfect Tomato. We are going to take a short break and be back with Farmer Jane.
Hey, kids, chatting together on the farm. I'm sitting something that you know and change the weather. But a California fire calls the night, so stick around. You're going to hear electric music, solid balls of sound.
Welcome back to Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Nicole Taylor. Hot Grease is produced by Jack Inslee and engineered by Nat Wiener. This program is sponsored by Whole Foods Market. See instant sale alerts, enter contests, find answers, and get cooking. Follow Whole Foods Market on Twitter at Whole Foods NYC. Let me give a Southern Girl's hug to Roberta's Restaurant. Located at 261 Moore Street in Brooklyn, New York, the location of two sustainable shipping containers known as Heritage Radio Network. Timra Costa works, cooks, gardens, and writes in the East Bay of California. She's a radio show co-host on Green 960, works as a food and communications consultant for various business, and author of the upcoming book, Farmer Jane, Women Changing the Way We Eat. Timra, welcome to
Hello,
Hot Grease.
Nicole.
Welcome to Hot Grease.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
One of my favorite quotes in the whole world is, no nation will rise any higher than its woman. And you're an example of us rising higher. Did you grow up aware of your power as a woman to transform a movement? Because I just look at all that you've done, and I just want to know, were you aware?
Wow, that's a really good question. You kind of stumped me on that one. Actually, I had to, you know, my empowerment really came through my rebellion as an adolescent. I think so many people go through that in their teenage years and just trying to find themselves, and I feel like I really had to push the boundaries of gender and other issues growing up in the Midwest, and it pushed me into my place of power, actually, through my adolescence.
And you've spent over 7 years employed and consulting in the nonprofit food system world. How important have female mentors and colleagues been in shaping who you are and the work that you're currently doing?
It's been absolutely critical, since that work really turned into Farmer Jane, Women Changing the Way We Eat. I found that I was surrounded by women in my day-to-day, and wonderful colleagues that are women. And women represent over 60% of the staff of sustainable agriculture nonprofits. So it's just uncanny at how many women are involved in this movement, and how many wonderful women I've been able to, you know, interact with that have really led me to where I am right now.
So I have a question, more so a dilemma that I'm trying to figure out. You know, I think we all know women who are like really smart. They're super successful and beautiful and they have it all, but they eat absolutely horribly. And I'm always in the position of, do I give this person advice? Do I lead by example? And I'm just curious to know, what is your advice on inspiring that friend to have a healthier lifestyle?
Have them over for dinner.
Ah.
I would say by making them some food that you feel is really healthy, it can inspire people to change their daily eating habits. I know that's been the case with my family, actually, growing up on not a local or sustainable diet at all, and just seeing the transition that they've made over the years with that information. I feel like it's a big educational, you know, opportunity to turn people on through flavors over a great meal.
I love your website. It's farmerjane.org. It's beautifully designed.
Hey.
You have a feature Farmer Jane. And I guess I should ask you to describe to our listeners, what are the characteristics of a Farmer Jane or a Farmer John?
Right. Well, the hope of Farmer Jane is that people will be able to identify that, you know, I could be Farmer Jane too, and that I'm changing our food system with every choice I make. I recently read a quote from Joe Salatin, who was speaking up in Washington, and he said that if you buy processed foods, you vote for a processed food system, but if you buy fresh foods, you're voting for a fresh food system. And so just letting people know that they can really engage in this. And what the website offers is that there are a ton of resources and a ton of organizations out there, no matter where you live, from the grassroots to the cities to the rural places, people are working to address these issues. You know, people are mothers, they're farmers, they're chefs, they're educators. And so what the featured Farmer Jane is doing, it's continuing to tell the story of women who are advocating for sustainable food throughout the country that I couldn't necessarily profile in the book because that would be a really large book. So I'm keeping it going. I've received so many interesting stories as I put out a call for nominations for inclusion in the book. And this is a way to just keep writing about women's lives and how they're impacting our food.
Yeah, I think you have Nikki Henderson up there. And she, if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong, I think she worked here in Brooklyn at Slow Food USA for a time before moving to the West Coast. Am I right or wrong?
That's correct. Yes, she did.
Okay, cool. So yeah. your book, Farmer Jane, Women Changing the Way We Eat, you profile 30 women who are changing our food system. Do tell some of the women, and these women are from all over the country, right? Tell some of the women that you're profiling in the book.
Well, it was a really fun project because I was able to look at how I define the sustainable food system and what are the different areas that each of the chapters would be based off of. So we have youth, women like Severin von Scharner Fleming, a very long name, but Severin is doing The Greenhorn. It's an organization and a documentary.
Oh, yeah. She has a show here on Heritage Radio Network, Greenhorns.
Yeah, she does. That's great. And then we have women that are doing direct-to-farm sales, like Nancy Vale at Pie Ranch out here in California. And this is, you know, bringing food to cities and educating urban people about how their food is grown. And we have educators and activists like Deborah Coons Garcia. She's a filmmaker and also my co-host on the Queens of Green on Green 960. And she really uses media as her lever for change. And then Millie Trevino Salceda, she's working on the farm worker piece. So these are conversations that aren't normally happening within the sustainable food world. It's just that women are behind this change in so many ways.
Yeah, I am totally excited about getting the book. It's not in stores now. It should be in stores at the end of the month or a few weeks, or is it in stores?
That's right. Yeah, May 1st. They started distributing a little bit early, so you can check with your local stores. It might be there, but the publication date is May 1st.
And you have a few upcoming appearances. I did not see any New York ones, but we have we have people all over the country that listen to Hot Grease. Where will you be next?
Well, next I'll be in St. Louis at the Livable Communities Conference, which is a great event that's happening on April 29th. Then, you know, most of my tour dates right now are set up on the West Coast, and people can look at my events online on farmerjane.org. And if they're interested in having me come and do an event, you know, on the East Coast, I'm definitely planning on spending some time on the East Coast and visiting with some of the women that are profiled in the book, like Judy Wicks from White Dog Cafe and Elizabeth Henderson, a CSA innovator, and Severin, of course. So I'm planning on coming out this fall, that's for sure.
Well, we definitely look forward to hosting you on Hot Grease and here at Heritage Radio Network. Thank you for joining us, and I'm looking forward to the book.
Thank you.
And stay in touch, and have a great
week. Well, thank you. Yeah, thanks. You're definitely a Farmer Jane, and I look forward to featuring you on my website.
Oh, cool. Thanks.
I'll be in touch.
Have a great one. Thank you again for listening to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. Join me every Monday at 3:30. Until then, always take the road less traveled.